All right. So for the last few weeks, actually, we have been going through Exodus chapter 20, and we wanted to kind of take our time and go through and cover all of the Ten Commandments. And so we finally got through all of those commandments. And so now we kind of move into an area that's I find kind of interesting, because it's almost like it's the Lord is providing a little bit more detail with regard to the law, kind of filling in some of the blanks. I guess the way I really see it is in a few different ways. Number one, so we have the Ten Commandments that are delivered to the people. And so there becomes, I think, immediately a question, right? A question is, well, okay, well, what happens if somebody breaks one of these laws? You know, what does it really mean? And so as we go through these next few chapters, the Lord is really providing some more detail to give a sense for which commandments are more important than others in a way, or have more serious consequences for violating them. And, you know, because the commandments are broken up into those two categories we talked about, you know, you have the categories, you know, as between us and God, and then you have the categories, you know, as between us and our fellow man. It's like the Lord is providing some, you know, guidance to those who would be judges, right? So you remember when Moses' father-in-law told Moses to select faithful men and wise men who could help him to judge, because everybody was bringing all these disputes to him and he had to resolve everything. And so Moses selected all of these individuals to serve as judges to resolve controversies and disputes among the people. And so in the law, there, as we covered, there were things in here that talked about how people are to relate to each other, you know, not murdering each other, not committing adultery, not stealing, not lying, and all those other things. And so in what's going to be covered in these next few chapters is guidance on how to deal with all of those violations of these various laws and stuff like that. And what's interesting is that the way I see it is that, you know, the Lord doesn't have to cover every single solitary potential thing that could take place. All he has to do is provide guidelines, and a person who is wise, you know, a judge who is wise will be able to take the wisdom that the Lord provides in these interpretations, and will be able to use them to apply to things that aren't specifically discussed in here. The Lord also makes it clear, like, that the things that he lays out in terms of the various punishments, that they're to abide by those things. So he makes it clear the things that are really important to be able to have justice, okay? And so all of this is, you know, it's all about what we had been talking about, right? And that is that the children of Israel, they were to be different. They were to be holy. They are to be set apart from all the other nations. And they're also to be, you know, witnesses. They're to be good witnesses to all of the nations around them. And when the nations around them would be able to look at them and how they're relating to each other and how there is justice there and how there is peace and how there is harmony going on in this community and in this nation, that it would serve as a witness to all the other nations around them that there's something different about them, and it has to do with their relationship, the relationship that they have with God. And so this is, I find this to be really interesting, because as we go through this, it kind of reminds me of my law school days, because you can see how the laws and these regulations that the Lord is laying out, that they ultimately end up forming the basis of the laws that we have in this country. And so It's really amazing. But one of the things that I also see from this is that, you know, the Lord really did provide all that was necessary so that if they were to live by these and they were to, you know, to strictly enforce these things, they would truly have a just nation and a nation that has, you know, peace and order and everything else. But as we're going to see, you know, the people did not follow these laws, and they, in terms of the enforcement of the laws, they weren't vigilant about enforcing them. But we'll get into all of that as we go along. So let's start out. We're starting out here in chapter 21 of Exodus, and we'll read and we'll talk about this as we go along. So chapter 21 of Exodus, verse 1 reads, "Now these are the judgments which you shall set before them. If you buy a Hebrew servant, he shall serve for 6 years, and then in the seventh he shall go out free and pay nothing. If he comes in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master has given him a wife, and she has borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. But if the servant plainly says, 'I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free, then his master shall bring him to the judges. He shall also bring him to the door or to the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him forever.'" So here we find the regulation here that the Lord provides with regard to a bond slave. And this is a really important part of the word, and it comes up a lot. And in fact, when I was teaching through the Pauline epistles, I would refer to this a lot. And so I'm going to spend a little bit of time in this. What's interesting about this is that if God actually in now turning to what I'm calling the regulations, it's like the Ten Commandments are the statutes, and then the regulations are like kind of the details in terms of how you are to, providing, I guess, more color, more detail to the law. And so it's interesting that God, in laying out these regulations, he begins with the lowest in the society. In other words, he's dealing with servants and slaves. He doesn't start out with the highest people in the society, the wealthy or priests or anything like that. But he starts out with servants. And essentially, the rule is as follows. If a person becomes a slave, that they are only to serve as a slave for 6 years, and in the seventh year, they go out from their slavery and they pay nothing. And the question is, well, how would a person in these times become a slave? And what could happen is that a person could end up becoming poor, and they're needy, they need food or clothing or whatever the case may be. And so they end up in debt. They end up owing someone a big debt that they can't pay. And so they would, what they would do is they would then sell themselves into slavery, and basically to work off the debt that they incurred for themselves. But in a way, that this particular law is an extension of the Sabbath. In a way, we talked about that a little bit. That there and we'll get to this later on. But that there would be every seventh year, there would be the setting free of slaves or servants that basically sold themselves into slavery to pay off a debt. And then also, likewise, if a person put their land up as security for an obligation, that land would also go revert back to the person who gave it up as a surety, and so and it occurs every 7 years. So the way that this particular law would work is that, you know, if you were in the, you know, the third year of this 7 year cycle, and you were to sell yourself into slavery, then you would only have to work for 3 more years and then you'd be set free, right? Because it is there is a defined seven year period that keeps rolling, you know? And so that means that, and so in any event, that this is how this whole thing worked. It goes on further to say that if a person comes in to this slavery by themselves, that if once that seventh year period ends, that they go out by themselves, okay? And so there could be a circumstance where a person comes in as a slave or a servant, and they come in by themselves, but then the master provides for that servant a wife. And then the wife, you know, the man and the wife end up having children. And so it's saying here, at the end of that 6 year period, if this person who comes in as a servant desires to be set free under this rule, they go out by themselves, even though the master gave them the wife. That wife remains the master's property, so to speak, as well as any children that they have. And so he has to make a decision as to whether or not he wants to go out free or whether he wants to stay there. But if he came in with a wife, that he would go out with the wife and then any children that they have during the time of the servitude. So that's kind of how, this is how it worked. But there was a provision in here that says that if the servant plainly says, like, you know, without any coercion, you know, any like, you know, the master is not, you know, placing any pressure on him or anything, but if the person just says, you know what, I love my master and I love the wife that he has given to me and the children that we've had, and I don't want to go out, I love this life that I have here, I can't think of a life that would be better than the life that I have here with my master, I want to stay. Then the servant, then they say, okay, if that's what you want to do, make up your mind and be sure that that's what you want to do. And if that person says they want to do that, then the master would take them to the doorpost and he would take an awl, which is an instrument to drill a hole in the servant's ear, and then they would have like a earring basically there, and that would be to signify that this person voluntarily decided that they wanted to be a servant for life, and it has to do with the master, okay? And so this has a lot of implication here. This is really a picture of something, okay? It's a picture of the fact that, you know, having to do with a bond slave. And what is it really a picture of? Well, the deal is this. In this life, we are in pursuit of, you know, trying to find the right master to serve, okay? And the reality is that there is no good master to serve except for the Lord. Every other master that we would serve, whether it be a human master, it would be cruel. Or if it were money, or if it were drugs, or if it were alcohol, or if it were pornography, no matter what master, whatever it is that we are serving, it's a cruel master, okay? And it's not until we find God, right? It's not until we find the good master that we then actually find peace, and we find that he actually does set us free. And so this is really a beautiful story, because we can think about ourselves in this, right? We can say that, you know, you can think about what it's like to serve the Lord and for Him to be our master, just how wonderful it is to be in His care, you know, that He takes care of us and He provides for us, and He sets us free from our sin, and He leads us and He guides us, and He tells us things that are to our benefit, you know, and so forth. And so that's really what a big part of this is. Now, one of the things that the reason why I ended up talking about this a lot is because in Paul's writings, he did two things. Number one is that he recognized that Jesus Christ was a bond slave. He made himself to be a servant to the Father and to do the will of the Father. And that's why you saw, all throughout the Gospels, Jesus saying that everything I do based upon what the Lord tells me to do. Everything I say based upon what the Lord tells me to say. And there are verses in the Old Testament and New Testament that point to the fact that Jesus was a bond slave. So one example of that is in Psalm chapter 40. And it's just a very simple verse. And if you weren't really looking at it closely, you may miss it. So in Psalm chapter 40, verse 6, it says, "Sacrifice and offering you did not desire. My ears you have opened." And so when it says you have opened, that's what that is, that means, is that the same idea of what we're reading about here, when the master would take the slave or the servant, and who would open, you know, use that all to make a hole there. "Burnt offering and sin offering you did not require." Verse 7, "Then I said, behold, I come in the scroll of the book, it is written of me, I delight to do your will, O my God, and your law is within my heart." And so we can see there that is really speaking of Jesus. In Hebrews chapter 10, it also speaks to that. So we look at Hebrews chapter 10. Verse 5. So Hebrews chapter 10, verse 5, it says, "Therefore, when he came into the world, he said," and this is speaking of Jesus, again, it's quoting Psalm 40, "Sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but a body you have prepared for me, in burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin, you had no pleasure. Then I said, behold, I have come. In the volume of the book, it is written of me, to do your will, O God." And so we see that truly this is really talking about the fact that Jesus was a bond slave. And then the other verse or place in the New Testament that talks about Jesus in this way is another place that I find myself referring to frequently in all of my studies, and that is in Philippians chapter 2. And Philippians chapter 2, starting at verse 5, it says, you know, "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God." But verse 7, look what he did. "But he made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant and coming in the likeness of men, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. Therefore, God also highly exalted him and gave him a name that was above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow, and of those in heaven and of those on earth and of those under the earth, and every tongue, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of the Father." And you know, I frequently say that, that's the one thing about Christ that fools those who don't know him, to the false religions and the scorners, basically, is that Jesus Christ and everything he did, it wasn't like he was like pretending to do something. Everything he did, it was all the way, like through and through, true, right? So he really did take on the form of a servant, and he really was submissive to the Father, and to the degree and the things that he said and the way he conducted himself, that people looked at him and said, there's no way he could be God. There's no way he could be divine, because he, look at what he's doing and look at what he's saying. It was so complete that way. And so that's the one thing that Paul did, was to really highlight and point to the fact that Jesus was that way. But the other thing about Paul is that he recognized in being a Christian, that meant that he himself was to be like Christ. And so what you find is that in the letters that Paul wrote, of some of them, when he started out those letters, he would say, you know, he would be identifying himself, and he would say, Paul, a bond servant of Christ, you know, a bond slave of Christ. And he was basically saying that I am going to be Christ-like, and I'm going to be a bond slave. But he was saying so much more than that. He was saying exactly what we're reading about in Exodus chapter 21. He's saying that I came to Christ and I became his servant. And when I began to serve him, I realized that it was the most amazing thing ever. I didn't want to be set free. The Lord has taken me in, and he has given me the privilege of serving him and doing his will. And he has blessed me. He has provided for me all that I need. And I don't want to go anywhere else. There is no other master. There is no other life that I want to live other than a life where I am a slave forever, you know, in the Lord's courts. And we do also see in Psalm 84 how it talks about how better one day in the courts of the Lord is better than 1,000 days anywhere else. And so that's what really this is all about. It's really interesting that, you know, the Lord is laying down this law here about servants and about how long they are to be servants until they're set free and all these other things. But by the same token, he's laying down something, you know, a picture. And that's just what we have been seeing, right? As we've been going through Genesis and Exodus, how the Lord is painting all these pictures for us so that we can see these different things. And so, again, I just think it's a beautiful picture for us, and it's something that we should be striving for, is to be like Christ, to be a bond servant, and to really understand and look around at what the Lord has done for us in our lives, and recognize that we don't want to go anywhere else. We want to serve the Lord forever. And we see that in verse 6. It says, and he shall serve him forever. And that's really what it's all about. Verse 7, it says, and if a man sells his daughter to be a female slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. And so this is really talking about a different circumstance. And this is a situation where a man would be selling his daughter to someone to be their wife, basically. And so by the very nature of this relationship, it wouldn't make any sense for that daughter to, after any period of time, to then leave and come back, right, or be set free. But there are all these conditions, though, that we're going to read about that would change this. And then we'll have a conclusion about this as well. So verse 8, it says, if she does not please her master, who has betrothed her to himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people, since he has dealt deceitfully with her. And so the one thing is, the condition is that the man who buys a daughter as a to be his wife, if after buying her he goes, I'm not happy with her, I'm not pleased with her as a wife, then he cannot sell her to a foreign people. That would be a problem. But he could allow her to be redeemed, you know, by the family. Verse 9, it says, if he has betrothed her to his son, like if he's allowed his son, you know, he was, you know, acquiring her for his son as a wife. It says he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. So that means that he has to treat her as if it's his actual daughter. And so he has to take care of her in that way. Verse 4, if he takes another wife, so this would be that he has acquired her as his wife, but then he now takes another wife, because at this time people had more than one wife and they could do that. It says that he would not be permitted to diminish her food or her clothing or her marriage rights. So just because he has this new wife, he could now start treating her poorly. And it says, and if he does not do these three for her, then she shall go out free without paying money. So in other words, if he doesn't follow these rules, that these conditions that I just read, then that means that he has broken the requirements here, the rules, the law, and therefore she has as a remedy that she could then be set free and she doesn't have to pay any money for her freedom. And so you look at this and say, boy, what a terrible thing for to put a daughter through. And so I think that is part of the story here, is that you shouldn't do that. If you're a father, you shouldn't do this, right, for your daughter, because it's it's a very bad thing. But there are circumstances where it could be an okay thing, right? Where a person is just saying, hey, you know, I love your daughter and I love her so much, I'm willing to pay a dowry in a way, right? And we know that a dowry was essentially like you're prepaying a alimony, right? So that if there were a divorce, or if the person died, that the family would have money to take care of their daughter. And so in any event, that's kind of what I get out of this, is don't sell your daughter, because it's not a good thing, even though the Lord has set up these rules that are designed to protect the daughter from being, you know, mistreated and abused. Verse 12, he who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. And so now, as we enter into verse 12, we're really looking at some regulations that relate to the commandment that we are not to murder, right? And coming out of chapter 20, verse 13. And so here it makes it very clear. So like the thing about these commandments are, you see these commandments and then you wonder, okay, what happens if you violate them? And so that's what this regulation is doing, is providing clarity regarding that. You violate this commandment here, which is the sixth commandment, you shall not murder. It says you will be put to death. That's the penalty for that, okay? So we find out right away that law is a very serious law, right? And we know that it is, Even from the very beginning, if you look all the way back to the third or fourth page of the Bible, and we see Cain killing his brother Abel, we see how the Lord reacts to that. And he, you know, he says that, you know, he goes on in what we read in Genesis, he says that if a person sheds blood, you know, basically kills someone, they have themselves to pay for that. And so the Lord takes human life very seriously. And he basically says, if a person strikes another man and he dies, he'll be put to death. But now he goes on in these regulations to provide, to deal with the, what you would call the different shades of gray or whatever, right? Because there are circumstances where a person can cause the death of somebody, but it is not a wrongful death, right? It is not a killing that requires a death as the consequence. And so the Lord, you know, provides this wisdom, right, to the judges to know how to deal with this. So verse 14, it says, verse 13 says, however, if he did not lie in wait, but God delivered him into his hand, then I will appoint for you a place where he may flee. And so what this is talking about is a situation where there is some kind of an accident that takes place. And in our law today, we talk about involuntary manslaughter. You know, where a person accidentally takes somebody's life. And later on, we're going to read about like an example of where, let's say a person is chopping, you know, a tree or chopping wood or whatever, and the axe head comes off and it hits somebody and it kills them. Okay, that would be an example of this kind of situation. And what this is hinting at is what will later be provided in the law, which is that the Lord is going to establish these cities of refuge, basically, so that if a person were guilty of this kind of thing, an accident, this involuntary manslaughter, there was a concept of an avenger of blood. In other words, a close relative of the person who was killed could take vengeance on that person. But the Lord is going to provide these cities of refuge, so that if you were if you had accidentally killed someone this way, you just have to get to the city of refuge, and then the avenger of blood cannot kill you as long as you stay in that city of refuge. But if you leave out of that city of refuge, then they can take your life. And then the other thing that is connected to that rule is that you had to stay there within the gates until the high priest dies. And then once the high priest dies, then you can leave the city of refuge and you can't be harmed. And so again, we end up with a picture, right? We end up with a picture of our high priest, right? Our high priest who died. And therefore, you know, we're able to go free from, you know, the sins that we have committed. And so it's a really amazing picture here that we're seeing. But the Lord is, again, it's showing the wisdom of the Lord and the how reasonable the Lord is, right? And saying that there is a kind of person who just goes out and kill somebody in a premeditated fashion. And then there are some cases where there's an accident. And although that life is really valuable, they're dealt with differently. Verse 14, we go back to the idea of premeditation and deliberation. So verse 14 says, but if a man acts with premeditation against his neighbor to kill him by treachery, you shall take him from my altar that he may die. And so that's an interesting phrasing there. What is it? What is that really saying when it says you shall take him from my altar that he may die. And this is an example of something that I've tried to explain whenever I see this kind of thing in the Word of God, I try to explain it that the Holy Spirit, in the way that he writes I use the word economically, there's just so much wisdom in it, in the sense that the Holy Spirit can, in that clause, you shall take him from my altar, is explaining a whole lot, okay? And what is this really getting at? This right here, you know, can be read together with verse 12, right? Because verse 12 says, if you strike a man so that he dies, you shall surely be put to death. That's a clear statement, very short, very much to the point. And this verse 14 is in contrast to verse 13. Verse 13 is you did it accidentally. And then verse 14 is saying you did it purposely. You premeditated. You sat down and you thought, I'm going to kill that person, and this is what I'm going to do. This is the weapon I'm going to use. This is when I see this guy, I'm going to go and I'm going to hide and I'm going to wait for him and I'm going to come out and I'm going to kill him. And he's saying that you got that kind of person. What he's saying here is that it says, even if that person goes to the altar and tries to ask the Lord for forgiveness and say that he has repented, and he's basically saying, oh, you know, please don't take my life. Have mercy upon me. I'm throwing myself on the altar, so to speak. He's saying that person, it says, take him from the altar that he may die. Because that's the whole thing. The Lord is laying out all this stuff because of things that he knows are going to happen, right? Because it's like, in a way, when people were having to deal with it, they go, oh my gosh, like, here's this guy, he's on the whole altar, he's grabbing onto the altar, and he's saying, like, please, Lord, forgive me, and I repent of this, I will never do it again. And you're thinking to yourself, God, what should I do? I don't know. Like, it looks like the guy is repenting, like, how can I kill him? And the Lord is saying, like, I don't care what this guy does. And that's what I mean when I say this is so economical. It's basically saying, this clause, you shall take him from the altar, is saying, I don't care what this guy does, okay? If he says that he has is repented, he says that he'll never do it again, he, you know, offers to pay money, he does any, I don't care what it is, you name it, all the way up to going onto the altar, he's saying that you grab that guy from that altar, and you take and you kill that guy, okay? That he may die, okay? So the Lord is making it really clear that, you know, that murder is not to be tolerated. It is the in a way, as between our relationships between our fellow man, it's the absolute worst thing you can do, right? Obviously. So it's very clear guidance here. Verse 15, it says, and he who strikes his father or mother shall surely be put to death. That is an amazing thing, right? Just think how much we would trim down our population today if we enforce that one. He who strikes his father or mother shall surely be put to death. In other words, it's not like something that you would say to yourself, God, I wonder if we should put this person to death, like, surely. And so again, we're looking at these laws and we're saying, what happens if you do it? And we're getting a sense for how important God sees the fifth commandment, right? You shall honor your father and mother. He takes that very seriously. And he says, a person that does that, they'd be put to death. They should surely be put to death. And if you think about it logically, right? we talked, when we went through and we were talking about the commandment to honor your father and your mother, we talked about how the Lord has set up certain institutions. He established them. The first institution that he establishes is the home, the family, the mother and the father. He also establishes government, and he establishes the church. And so if you don't obey you don't obey your father and mother, you're rebelling against them, you're striking them, what are you going to do when you go out into the world? And that's one of the things that I don't want to get too involved in political things, but you know, I've personally seen how a person can be rebellious against their parents, and how that rebellion, it shows up when they go out into society and when they're dealing with police officers and everything else. Believe me, if a person doesn't have respect for their parents and they're willing to strike their parents, there is no telling what they're gonna do to anybody else, including a police officer. That person doesn't have any respect for anything, okay? And so that's just what this is all about. And so the Lord just says in his wisdom, he says, that person shall surely be put to death. If you don't do it, it's just going to be, you're going to regret it, right? Because you're just going to end up having a society that where you have lawlessness, right? And you have rebellion, you have violence. Verse 16, it says, he who kidnaps a man and sells him, or if he is found in his hand, shall surely be put to death. So that is very simple, right? Kidnapping is a capital crime. But then in verse 17, he comes back to the issue of respecting and honoring your father and mother. And he says in verse 17, and he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Again, amazing, huh? I mean, who would have thought that the Lord takes this so seriously, that the mere cursing of the father or mother would is a capital crime? Just think how many people would be dead today if this were strictly followed. Verse 18, if men contend with one another and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, and he does not die, but is confined to his bed, if he rises again and walks about outside with his staff, then he who struck him shall be acquitted. He shall only pay for the loss of his time and shall provide for him to be thoroughly healed. And so here we see that there is a requirement for restitution. And so this, again, we're still within that commandment of thou shalt not murder. And we talked about this when we were talking about the commandments themselves, and that is that these commandments are broader than just, you know, don't murder. I mean, the idea is that we're not to seek to do harm to anyone, right? We're to be looking out for the good of our fellow man, not to be harming them. And so what this is saying when it says contending with each other, you know, two people, they get into a fight with each other, and they're you know, wrestling, and they're throwing blows at each other, and they end up hurting somebody to the point where they're confined to their bed, they can't work, and so forth. And so now this is basically saying they have to provide restitution. They don't have a workers' comp, right, or anything like that. And notice that the restitution is to be provided by the one who did the harm. It's not like the entire population of Israel is putting money into a fund that would then provide restitution to this person. So that's what is required here. Verse 20, it says, And if a man beats his male servant, male or female servant, with a rod so that he dies under his hand, he shall surely be punished. And so here we see that the Lord he's seeking to protect servants. You know, he doesn't want for servants to be mistreated. And so here we have a situation where a man who has a servant does have a right to discipline that servant if they're disobedient, but the Lord does not allow. They are valuable to him, these servants. And so he does not allow them to kill the servant. And so it says that if he beats his servant with a rod so that he dies under his hand, it says he shall surely be punished. And that punishment is the death penalty. So you can't go around killing your servant. But then verse 21, it says, notwithstanding, if he remains alive for a day or two, he shall not be punished, for he is his property. And so, as I said, there is the servant, I mean, the master has the right to punish his servant. But this is basically saying that if he remains alive for a day or two, that you can infer from that he did not have a desire to kill the servant. And so therefore he would not be punished if he stayed alive for a day or two. So basically this is, again, it's demonstrating God's value for life, even for a person who finds himself being a servant. And so this is going to require or cause a master to think twice before they, you know, when they go to discipline their servant, that they would do so in a way that is responsible, right? So that they don't kill them. Verse 22, it says, if men fight and hurt a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows, he shall surely be punished accordingly as the woman's husband imposes on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. And so here we just have a situation again where you have these two people, they're fighting, and all of a sudden they bump into, or they, you know, they take a big swing with some object or something, they hit a woman in her stomach, and so now all of a sudden she goes into labor and she has this child prematurely. But the child ends up living, nothing, there's no harm that follows, then it says that they will be punished according to what the husband is asking and what the judges, when they come and judge this situation, what they determine to be the right restitution or compensation for the harm that they've done to this woman here. And again, it's really, like I said, it's really interesting that our laws, you can see this and see how our laws really grew out of this. That this wisdom that the Lord provided helped us to be able to establish our laws. We wouldn't have any idea what to come up with, or, you know, what kinds of laws. But then it goes on in verse 23 to say, but if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. Okay? And so we see here that if the person does, though, harm this woman who's pregnant and the child dies or is harmed, like let's say that the child's eye, they're born but their eye was knocked out or something like that, then that's what's going to happen to the person who caused this harm. They're gonna gouge out that person's eye. But notice, though, that if the child dies, that person who caused that child to die is to suffer a capital punishment. And so we see here that, you know, this, you know, God considers an unborn child to be a human life. And so whoever takes that life, they're guilty of murder. And so it doesn't matter what other people say about this topic. This is what God thinks about this. And so this would be a verse that you can look at to see, you know, what does God think about the killing of a life that is in the womb. Verse 27, and if he knocks out the tooth of his male or female servant, verse 26, if a man strikes the eye of his male or female servant and destroys it, he shall let him go free for the sake of his eye. And if he knocks out the tooth of his male or female servant, he shall let him go free for the sake of his tooth. And so here we see, again, the Lord showing a care and concern for the lowest in the society, for the servant, and is basically saying that if a man, you know, strikes the, you know, you have a master, right, who is striking the eye, and if it he destroys their eye, then that servant can go free, and if he knocks out their tooth, they can go free. That's the way it was. And notice that, you know, the Pharisees, when they were dealing with Jesus, they, you know, it came out that they were teaching that this was something that you had to do, that must be done, that you know, that there would be, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, and all that. But what I'm saying now is actually relating to what I read before about if there is this harm to life, and that is that. But Jesus didn't teach us. He taught that there could be forgiveness, right? You could turn the other cheek. And so it's something I wanted to say there. But then with regard to going back to the servant here, the bottom line is that if a master causes this harm to the servant's eye or to their tooth, that they would have they would have to let that servant go free. Okay, so now we get to verse 28, and now we're going to start talking about property. And so verse 28 says, if an ox gores a man or a woman to death, then the ox shall surely be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be acquitted. And so what we're seeing here is that, again, we're seeing that the Lord values human life, and he values the human life greater than the life of an animal. And so if an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox is to be stoned, and they're not to eat the flesh of it. And the owner would not be punished in any way for that. And so the idea here is that you have this ox, and now we know that this ox has this propensity to kill, right? And so you got to get rid of it. Verse 29, we see another principle. It says, but if the ox tended to thrust with its horn in times past, and it has been made known to his owner, and he has not kept it confined, so that it has killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner shall also be put to death. And so here we have a situation where we have in our current laws, it would be called, you know, criminal negligence, right? We have an owner that has an ox, and they know, they see that this ox has this tendency to thrust with its horns, you know, and other people, it says, and it's been made known to its owner, other people has pointed this out. If you notice that your ox is a little testy, you know, you need to do something to make sure that ox is kept confined so it doesn't harm anybody. And it says, but he, you know, even though he knows all this, he doesn't keep the ox confined. And as a result, it then goes and it kills a man or a woman. In this particular case, not only is the ox to be stoned, but the owner also shall be put to death because the owner didn't value human life. He's not looking out for the life of others. So again, this particular one is flowing out of that law of you shall not commit murder. And we're seeing that not only are we not to engage in some affirmative act that would cause the death of someone else, but we should be, again, like, you know, how Jesus says that we should love our neighbor as ourselves. We should do unto others what we would want them to do. So in other words, if it were me, I would want my neighbor, if they had an ox that was prone to kill, I want them to put their ox away. And so if I have an ox like that, then I should put them away. And you know, you're just really, you're valuing life and you're not wanting any harm to be done. I'll give you an example. You know, like if you went into Starbucks, okay, and you got a cup of coffee, and as you're going to, you know, over to put your a half and half into the, back in the days when you could actually handle the half and half, you went to put half and half in your coffee and you spilled a little bit on the floor, you know, there would be a thought in your mind, you'd say, you know, I'm going to clean this up because somebody could come over here and not see this, and then they'd slip on the floor and they'd fall and hurt themselves. And that's what that's the way the Lord wants us to think with regard to our relationships with others. And so that's why, that's really what I mean when I say that it's not just about, you know, saying like, hey, I didn't murder him, I didn't harm him, but you're also like, you're really wanting the best for people. You're wanting to keep people out of harm's way. You want to make sure you conduct yourself in a way that where people can't be harmed. You know, drive down the street at 100 miles per hour or something like that, or, you know, things like that. So that's the idea behind this. And so the same principle is taking place here in this verse 29. This guy has this wild ox, and, you know, oxen are, they're like that, right? They're bound to be that, like that. So it's not like you have to take and destroy. Like if you see any ox that you have and it, you know, thrusts its horns, you don't have to destroy all of them, but it's saying that you need to take care. You need to go and keep it confined, figure out a way to put it in a place where it can't harm anyone. That's the idea. Verse 30, it says, if there is imposed on him a sum of money, then he shall pay to redeem his life, whatever is imposed on him. Whether it has gored a son or gored a daughter, according to his judgment, it shall be done him. And so here we see something different going on here in verse 30. In this rule in verse 29, where the owner would be put to death, it's saying that if the family of the person who got killed by the ox says, hey, look, we don't want you to be killed. We don't want this guy to be killed, you know, because of what happened here. You know, it's a horrible thing, and we don't want to make matters worse. You know, if he pays us X number of dollars for this, we'll, you know, forget about it. You know, you don't. And so basically, there's an out here. It's basically saying, if there is imposed on him a sum of money, you know, the judge or the family says, hey, you know, pay this money, then, you know, to redeem your life, then, and he pays it, then he will, he won't, have to be, put to death. Just a few more, verses here. I know we're running over here. It goes on to say, if the ox gores a male or female servant, he shall give to their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. Now, this is a very, very interesting verse, and I'm sure you can see why it is, because this particular verse, it supplies the amount that that the male or female servant is quote unquote worth. Okay, so in other words, we have a situation where a servant is being killed, and it's saying that if the person just pays 30 shekels of silver, then only the ox of that man would be stoned, but they wouldn't be stoned themselves. And so what we see here is that Judas, he betrayed Christ for the value of a servant. You know, it shows that that's what Judas did, the price he received for betraying Christ was 30 pieces of silver. And so it's kind of amazing how we see this in the law taking place. So I'm going to stop right here. This is as good a place as any, because we're going to continue on in the next few chapters, and we're just going to be covering, you know, just regulation after regulation. And so, again, this is a good a place as any to stop. There's no reason to feel like we need to go through the whole chapter 21.